So this week, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to have a conversation with former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis from South Carolina, who has become a huge climate change advocate and is involved on the front lines of the climate struggle in terms of policy solutions involving the private sector. He's a former Republican congressman from South Carolina, served from, he got elected in 92, lost a U.S. Senate race to Fritz Hollings. He was the Republican nominee in 98, lost to Fritz Hollings, who was the longtime Democratic senator in South Carolina. Ernest Hollings' final term. And then he came back when Jim DeMint ran for the Senate, took his old seat, Greenville-Spartanburg area seat, back in 2004. And was much more moderate, if you want to just look at ideology in his second stanza in the second 6-year period in the House, and got beat in a primary by Trey Gowdy in 2010, the Tea Party year. So really, you know, in terms of ideology, I would call him a traditional conservative, but he's a guy that I think on the current ideological scale is very middle of the road in terms of his ideology and policy preferences, and in fact, endorsed President Biden's 2020 campaign against Donald Trump. So anyway, very, very insightful, interesting conversation with him we're about to have. So stay tuned. Congressman, you're involved now in a really exciting venture that you're the executive director of, which is so important when we talk about climate change and providing solutions, and also educating conservatives perhaps about the issue and how we can develop some free market solutions to climate change.
Yeah, it's republicen.org. That's EN for energy, entrepreneurship, environment. We're conservatives who care about climate change and who believe that there are free enterprise solutions that could spread worldwide very rapidly and start addressing the problem. So we're out to convince fellow conservatives to get in this conversation and to start advancing the solutions that we know will work because they're based on free enterprise.
When you were in Congress, there was more of a bipartisan consensus, perhaps, than today around these sorts of issues. And take us through a little bit of what you worked on in your 12 years, I mean, 2 6-year stints in Congress on this issue, because some of those solutions, some of those proposals which were not implemented, are the core of what you're talking about today in 2023 that we need to revisit.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that really my political life is sort of a measuring life of action on climate change. You know, when I was my first 6 years in Congress, I said the climate change was nonsense. I didn't know anything about it except that Al Gore was for it. and as much as, you know, I represented a very conservative district in South Carolina, that was the end of the inquiry. Okay, that's pretty ignorant, but that's the way it was for my first 6 years in Congress. Then I was out of Congress 6 years, had the opportunity to run for the same seat again in 2004. That's the year that our son, the eldest of our 5 kids, just turned 18. So he was voting for the first time. And he came to me and said, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." His 4 sisters who agreed, his mother agreed, new constituency, you know? So that was step one. Step two was going to Antarctica, the science committee, and seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. And then step three was another science committee trip and another, and something of a spiritual awakening with being inspired by the faith of an Aussie climate scientist and his response to this challenge. And so that's how this guy that used to dispute climate change became a climate change, I don't know, activist, but basically a guy who says we gotta do something about it. So that was my metamorphosis. And then you look at the politics of it. When I was running again in 04, it was okay that change had happened. The economy was pretty good. People were pretty content with circumstances, and you know, there's a widespread agreement that we need to do something about climate change. After all, it was George H.W. Bush who had sort of first identified it at the White House level as something we need to do, act on climate change. And so then get on over there to like 2008 and to show how much consensus there was, like you were just referencing. Early 08, Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, is on the couch with Nancy Pelosi, another, at that point, the Speaker of the House, saying, don't agree on much, do we, Newt? No, Nancy, but we agree climate change is real and we need to do something about it. That was early 08. So there's broad consensus, just like you were just saying, that you know, Republicans and Democrats agreeing, we need to do something. End of 08, Newt had switched. We don't know, he said. And of course, the things that had happened that had caused him to switch, I think, were the election of Barack Obama and the coming of the global financial crisis and the beginning of the Great Recession. And so that's where we took this big, long detour into climate disputation. You know, we don't call it denial at Republican.org because people who dispute climate change say that equates them with Holocaust denial. So we give them the courtesy of calling them disputers. Mm-hmm. They dispute the science. And so we went through this time of them saying we don't, basically they were in aggressive disbelief about climate change. It was essentially, I don't believe in climate change, you shouldn't either. And it was because of the Great Recession, we thought. Then, you know, things have changed and improved. It's now different. It's getting better. Not quite there yet, but we're getting better because Republicans now are more inclined not to dispute the obvious about climate change. You know, when the water is 98 degrees in some places, 100 degrees around South Florida, ocean water. It's hard to dispute that something's going on. And so now the disputation is more like, yeah, but how we get China in? And that's where we are now. So we've gotten through that period of out-and-out denial of climate change because it's getting pretty obvious. And we're now in a situation of, yeah, devise a solution, though, that gets the world in. That's the challenge at the moment.
So being someone who was really active on policy issues, particularly your second 6 years, right, from 04 to 2010, you have some really creative solutions that you talk about on your website, and you've talked about in presentations and speeches you've given, working with various constituencies and with sitting Republican elected officials and others. So walk us through some of those, because I think that they're a logical starting point for dealing with this.
Yeah, you know, really, there are three ways to fix climate change. I know that sounds like an overstatement. Like, how could it just be three? You know, broadly speaking, there are three ways to fix it. One is you can attempt to regulate emissions. Problem is, you can't regulate Chinese emissions from here in America. So that's sort of a hard comeuppance to that first option, right? Second policy option is to incentivize clean energy. We have done this now in the Inflation Reduction Act. And those are going to work for American tax-paying firms, because if you pay taxes in America, then tax credits in the American tax code are really powerful. But if you don't pay American taxes, say you're a Chinese company, those tax incentives don't help you and they don't change your economics. So we may, in that second option of, you know, incentives for clean energy, we may clean up American air, which would be a good thing. Fewer asthma cases, longer life expectancy, fewer hospitalizations. It'll be good here in America to do those things. But we won't yet be solving climate change, because devilish problem about climate change. You got to get the whole world in. So then the third approach, which obviously I favor now, having dissed number one and number two, is to just put on a carbon tax, pair it with a reduction in payroll taxes, so there's no growth of government. And so, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the bottom 70% of Americans would do better in that tax swap, where you give them a fuller paycheck because you're reducing their payroll taxes or FICA taxes. You know, on your check from your employer, it's 6.2% in the FICA box that you pay. What you're not seeing is the employer is paying the other 6.2%. So it's a whopping 12.4% tax. So the our thought would be reduce that tax, put a tax on carbon dioxide instead, and then apply that tax to imports. And that can be done. And if it's done, then you get the whole world in, because that's the exciting thing about this third option is if you have that domestic carbon price, carbon tax, and since we're conservatives, we want to pair it with an equal reduction in existing taxes so there's no growth of government. But if you do that, then under World Trade Organization rules, it's okay to apply that tax to imports coming from countries that don't collect the same carbon tax as we would have in their home countries. And so it makes it in the interest of our trading partners at that point to do the same thing that we're doing. And then the whole world is following. So it's a concrete example. There's a sheet of flat steel coming from China right now, let's say. It's coming through the port of Seattle. We apply our carbon tax. China objects in the World Trade Organization. They say, no, you can't do that. It's an impermissible tariff. We think they lose that case based on precedents in the chemical industry that say, oh no, you can have a content tax on the based on the content of the stuff coming in. And this would be a carbon content tax. If we're right, and if it's upheld, China, 24 hours later, because they do reach consensus very efficiently in China, you know. They're not a very fair government, not a very nice government, doggone efficient though. Dictatorships are that way. You know, it's an efficient way to run a government is to be a dictator. And so not a very nice one, you know, not that turned out to be nice, but efficient. And so why 24 hours later? Well, they just paid in Seattle a carbon tax that they could have collected themselves. If they collected themselves, the tax money would be in Beijing. But since they didn't collect it, we're collecting it in America, in Seattle, and we're sending it to Washington, D.C. So 24 hours later, China says, nothing doing. We'll collect it ourselves, and there'll be no adjustment on entry of that good, that sheet of flat steel front through the port of Seattle. So then the whole world starts following. Because if you're doing business in the world, you're doing business with America and China. And then you get the whole world, 8 billion people, seeing the true cost of the burning of fossil fuels. It's built into the price of all products. And then consumers, in the liberty of enlightened self-interest, start choosing their self-interest. They choose the products that have a lower carbon footprint because they're cheaper. And so cleaner becomes cheaper. And dirty, made accountable, becomes more expensive. As it should be, you know. It's just all about accountability. So that's three options. You can attempt to regulate it, you can incentivize it, or you can tax it. And we think taxing it, as long as you give me a corresponding tax cut somewhere else, and applying it to imports, is the way to make it go worldwide.
And I should point out that tax cut, FICA tax cut, would be extremely progressive in terms of how it impacts the working class, right? I mean, that's part of the consideration here.
Absolutely. And it's very important that I, as a conservative, say, address this question of regressivity, you know. A carbon tax by itself is regressive. It would hurt poor people. And I believe that conservatives should be the first ones to mention that, because we maintain that we're for equal opportunity. Well, if that's the case, then make sure any policy you've got doesn't hurt poor people, because you're trying to incentivize work and industry and moving ahead in life. Well, if you set up the deal so that actually they get hurt, then it's sort of it shows the lie of your philosophy. So as a conservative, we think we should be the first to mention the problem of regressivity with the carbon tax. But if you apply the carbon tax and then pair it immediately with a reduction in payroll taxes, that's a very effective way to deal with the regressivity of carbon tax. And just give you some numbers, a $30 per ton price on carbon dioxide, $30 carbon tax at the mine, at the pipeline here in America, would result in a price increase of a gallon of gasoline at the local pump of 30 cents a gallon.
My goodness.
And about $11 a month on the average family's electricity bill. So 30 cents a gallon, $11 a month. That's not a big deal for somebody that's making a lot of money, but for a poor person, it really hits them. And so you untax their payroll, though, and they're paying that 30 cents a gallon, and they're paying the $11 a month, and they actually do better, says the Congressional Budget Office.
The private sector has in many cases already stepped up in trying to combat climate change, or at least trying to curb some of the excesses that may have helped lead to this. And you mentioned the Inflation Reduction Act, which has had has its incentive structure in there. Your conversations with the private sector and with people who are in business, how have those gone, and are they open and welcoming to some of these suggestions?
It depends on who you are. For example, in the petroleum business, if you're a Marathon of Ohio, you're not so open, because they don't have any natural gas in their portfolio, and they just sell petroleum at their gas stations. So they sell petroleum and chips and soda. And they're very opposed to a carbon tax, because they think that it would hurt their business. But ExxonMobil, which has a very large natural gas portfolio, says, yeah, bring it on. That's what we would prefer. ExxonMobil says, don't try to regulate our business. Don't do these incentives which expire. Just do a carbon tax, and we'll figure it out from there. And it's because, I once said to the lady that used to give me pack checks from ExxonMobil, I said, Jeannie, listen, if I'm in front of folks and there's some progressives in the audience, they're going to say ExxonMobil was never for anything, no action on climate change. They were just talking about that carbon tax in order to distract people. And she set me straight, because she's a very straight shooting kind of gal. She says, Bob, we sell two products. We sell petroleum and natural gas. If you put on a carbon tax, natural gas beats coal better than it's beating it now. That's why we're for a carbon tax. And I said, oh, great, Jeannie. I can go tell fellow conservatives, you're just trying to make money. What else would be believable? But here's the thing. If you can sell natural gas to make electricity, and it produces, and making that electricity, it produces 50% less CO2, good on you. It stinks for coal, because coal is going to, it's going to be found out as being really dirty. 6 coal-fired plants in South Carolina have converted to natural gas. We're breathing a little better in South Carolina because of it. And so it depends on, as typical in politics, where you sit determines where you stand. And in business, in answer to your question, where you're invested determines where you stand. So if you're Marathon of Ohio, you think a terrible idea that Inglis is talking about here. If you're ExxonMobil, you say, yeah, good idea. That would work for us. So it just depends. But and people that are typically in industries that are dirty, like coal, it's hard for them. There's no way around it. It's just hard. But if you're in natural gas, for example, you're probably more excited about some kind of carbon pricing mechanism, because it's gonna help you make a lot of money.
So in terms of working with current elected officials and governors of states, people in the U.S. Senate, U.S. House, you're having some success, and this is opening the door to conservatives working towards solutions for climate change. Bring us up to speed on maybe one or two of those efforts.
Yeah, you know, I think the most exciting thing happening right now is actually in the Senate, where there's some Republicans, Kramer of North Dakota and Cassidy of Louisiana in particular, who are working on what I just referenced a minute ago, which is this carbon border adjustment mechanism. It sounds like a lot of words, but basically what it means is applying at our borders a corrective to Chinese imports or to imports from countries that don't have their own carbon tax. And so in the case of Kevin Kramer of North Dakota and Senator Cassidy of Louisiana, you have them talking about a way of applying that tax. And I think that's really exciting. The first step of that is something called the PROVE Act. PROVE Act. And so the idea is to create good data here in the United States, gather good data. It sounds sort of wonky, but it makes sense. Is we need to know how many emissions we've got in American steel, for example, since I'm sticking with the steel as an example. And once that data is gathered, then we can know how we compare to other countries, which will be very important, especially as the European Union starts applying its own carbon tax on entry of our goods to the European Union. You know, starting this year, people that export stuff into the European Union have to substantiate their carbon footprint. They have to say, you know, in this sheet of flat steel, this is how much carbon was emitted. Starting in 2026, if that steel is dirtier than European steel, then you'll have to pay essentially a carbon tax. If it's cleaner than European steel, then you won't have to pay the tax. So we in the PROVE Act, it's a step toward helping us be ready for that action in Europe, which is a major trading partner for us. And also, I think in the process, what it's going to do is help us to see, hey, you know what? We could do what the Europeans are doing. We could do it to China. We could make it so that China and the rest of the world gets in on climate action. And again, that overcomes the major hurdle right now that we find among fellow conservatives. You know, they've stopped arguing with thermometers pretty much and with yardsticks and rulers about sea level rise. But they do want to know how you get the world in. And we think that's the work that Kevin Kramer are doing and Senator Cassidy are doing, I think, will help figure out how to get the world in.
Outstanding. And how can our listeners and readers find you and your website and all the work you're doing online?
It's easy. You go to republicen.org. So it's republicen.org. Again, EN for energy, entrepreneurship, the environment. And if they'll sign up with us, the join button will follow you wherever you go on the website. It takes about 45 seconds. All we need is your email address so we can stay in touch. We won't hound you for money. We've got great donors that help us with that. Once a year, we do give everybody the opportunity to give if they want to, but we don't hound you for money. But we also want your zip code, because in that zip code, we can be able to make you visible to your member of Congress and to your two senators. They're starting to get it that there are conservatives who care about climate change. We just need to show them that community is growing. And so that's why we really hope people will join us at republicen.org.
Thank you so much, Congressman. That was a fascinating conversation. And we want our listeners, actually, doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you are on, to check out their website, check out their work, understand some of these potential policy solutions, because this affects Florida directly. Thank you for listening again, and we'll be back next week.